Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Monday night installment here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various offensive litigating strategies. This is with our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy Is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy Is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy Is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups that Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Your Remedy Is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much like how you think of a social a network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated to yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. Every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. The information provider's payments to Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. The unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call the letter and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, I thank you very much for your disclaimer there and sharing with us all. We're going to have a very, very exciting call tonight. I can promise you that. I've got some things to share with you, not only historical court cases, but even a confession from the Secretary of State of Montana on a document I received today. And we're going to talk about that some more. I want to welcome Alan on the call tonight. He was with us last week, if you remember. Alan is a phenomenal researcher, did tremendous work with regards to Title 18, specifically proving that it never was lawfully passed. And we'll invite Alan to share comments after PJ opens up the lines for questions and answers to also chime in, because his depth of understanding and knowledge is just beyond pale. And so that having been said, you know, I start every call when we have new first-time callers. I unmute their phone. I ask them for their first name only. That's simply so I can associate their first name with the phone number that I have already, you know, captured, if you would, on my desktop here. I have a telephone board, if you would, that identifies everybody that calls in and so forth. So anyways, and the purpose for this is that in the near 30 years that I have been marketing what I call information providers, people like PJ, people like Alan, and there's a Saturday, it's Bernie, and there's so many others. I have 7-8 different people that I deal with as far as offering their services to you. I call them information providers. I want to firmly establish that everything that we do is a teaching mode about law and has nothing to do with, quote, practicing law without a license, end quote. And the reason that I have this record is because, well, after nearly 30 years, I have watched other marketing people, even those information providers that just market themselves, they fail to give a thorough disclaimer. And you know, you've heard it here on the call. If you're here for legal advice, leave. Can't be more clear than that. With that having been said, let me start first with Eugene, Oregon, ending in 7838. May I have your first name only, please? Eugene, Oregon, ending in 7838. Just your first name. If you don't want to give it, make one up. I don't care. I hear you.
Sorry, Jimmy?
I hear you. Yeah, just give me a name, please.
Hi, can you hear me now?
I hear you perfectly clear. Just looking for a name.
Jimmy or Jim.
Jimmy. All right. No, I go with Jimmy. I like Jimmy.
Actually, I didn't press a thing to ask a question. I was just listening in on the call.
Yeah, it's no problem. I just want to make sure that if somebody ever says that Jimmy didn't hear the disclaimer, then I'm going to say, no, he sure did, because I got that checked. Thank you for joining us, Jimmy. Thank you for joining us. And I've always loved the name Jimmy. Jimmy Crackcorn, I don't care, you know, whatever it was. And the second one is Cortland, Virginia, ending in 2563. May I have your first name only, please?
Mitchell.
Thank you, Mitchell. We appreciate you. Thank you very much. All right, now for the good stuff I want to share with you. I'm going to start by reading an article of different court cases that apply to citizenship, be it the difference between state citizenship and federal citizenship. In Colgate versus Harvey, quote, the governments, plural, of the United States and of each state of the several states are distinct from one another. The rights of a citizen under one may be quite different from those which he has under the other, end quote. In Rustart versus People, quote, there is a difference between privileges and immunities belonging to the citizens of the United States as such and those belonging to the citizens of each state as such. Wadley versus Newell, the rights and privileges and immunities which the 14th Constitutional Amendment and section of 1979, which is U.S. Comp Street, 1901, page 1262, quote, for its enforcement were designated to protect are such as belonging to citizens of the United States as such and not as citizens of a state. The lines are clearly drawn today as they were from the beginning. Let's take a look at some fundamental distinctions regarding the United States, what the United States is, and where it gets its authority from, what the states of the Union are in and of themselves and in relation to the United States, and where the states of the Union get their authority from. I can remember as a child reciting the Pledge of Allegiance in the public elementary schools each morning at the start of class, hand over the heart, I'd say, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Every morning, repeating the same thing, I came to grow up and discover that the United States is actually not one nation. This erroneous idea has colored the understanding and perception of American society and en masse has fed our ignorance with regards to those who are in the relationship to the government. And here are a few presumptions that are in error. The federal government is superior to the states of the Union. Federal law supersedes state law. The United States of America is one nation. None of these presumptions are, in fact, true. They're all false. Here's what's really going on, as it's always been since its inception. The Declaration of Independence created not one, but 13 brand new nations or countries. The United States of America is actually a collection of nations banded together for a common purpose. The federal government has only limited authority that is separate, distinct, and foreign to the states of the Union. The United States Constitution is the offspring of the Declaration of Independence and the Articles of Confederation and requires that the federal government is still a government of limited, enumerated authority. All that the states of the Union have is a political agreement with the United States, whereby the states of the Union have delegated limited authority to the United States for specific purposes as are outlined in the U.S. Constitution. It is historically and politically incorrect, as well as contrary to the determination of the United States Supreme Court, to refer to American society as a nation or a country. It is proper to refer to the American political alliance as a society as the United States of America is an alliance of nations, a confederation of sovereign states. Each state of the Union is separate, distinct, unique, and foreign to each other, as the laws of one state do not operate within the borders of any other state. The two ways of which an act of Congress becomes operable within any state of the Union are by way of the U.S. Constitution and by cession. Each state has their status of any other nation on the world. Each state in our Union has its own constitution, its own land over which it exercises jurisdiction, its own citizens, its own legislative, executive, and judicial branches of government, its own police powers, its own prison systems, and military. Both the state's militia and the National Guard are under the control of the governor of the state, who acts as commander-in-chief over them. This leaves one born in any of the 50 states with options of citizenship. Because each state of the Union has a separate sovereignty from that of the United States, there are at least two types of citizenship in America: state citizenship and United States citizenship. While most Americans readily and frankly unwittingly claim to be U.S. citizens, the provision of these two types of American citizenship are distinct from each other. I personally prefer to not use the term citizen at all, and I'm kind of like the name national instead, state national. Today, the term is presumed to mean the U.S. citizen. To avoid any confusion, one has nationality with their respective nation states that they were born in and can utilize the title of state national as they see fit. The Supreme Court of the United States makes a clear distinction between the two types of citizenship in a decision or a ruling called, and this is the California Supreme Court, excuse me, in a type of citizenship in the case of Tashiro versus Jordan. It's 1927, so it's less than 100 years old. This is the California Supreme Court. Quote, that there is a citizenship of the United States and a citizenship of a state, and the privileges and immunities of one are not the same as the other, is well established by the decisions of the courts of this country, end quote. Now, considering the authorship is California, when they refer to country, they're referring to themselves. And, of course, you remember in weeks past, I talked about how in 1959, Alaska came into the Union. And I want to thank a nice lady named Jennifer that brought this to my attention, they had to get finances to pay for a federal judge, to bring in Alaska as a territory to translate Alaska into one of the freely associated compact states. That was the quote they used, freely associated compact states. And that's, of course, recognizing the states of the Union as opposed to the federal government. All right, so all that's so interesting, isn't it? Well, we got more. This morning, or this afternoon, I received from a student from another information provider paperwork on the corporation Soul that was established this morning in Montana. And there are entity details. The religious denomination is Star Ventures Society. Name of the leader is, I'll just say, Juanita. And then it's got designation of boundaries. I started reading this and my jaw dropped. It says throughout, and I'm going to, when I speak this, I'm going to have to be a little difficult, and you're going to hear me say uppercase or lowercase. And that's because it is so incredibly important what is being said here. Quote, throughout the lowercase state of uppercase Montana, comma, in any state, comma, territory, comma, district, comma, or possession of the United States, comma, or in any state of the lowercase United, lowercase states, lowercase of, uppercase America, comma, or in any foreign country. Now, what they've done here, let me close this and get back to my other note. Here we go. Listed first in this section that just this morning, Montana clearly delineated the boundaries upon which this was applicable. They said, quote, throughout the state of Montana. State of Montana. Remember me telling you about the state of Montana being different from Montana? Montana being one of the freely associated compact states, the state of Montana being a creation under the Buck Act of 1940 to become a, if you would, a territory of the United States. And then it continues, comma, in any state, which would be any of the state of states, state of Montana, state of Florida, state of California, whatever, these creations under the Buck Act, territory, district, or possession of the United States. So this clearly talks about the lands and the people under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the various states' federal constitution. And then continuing, this mentions the states, quote, within the freely associated compact states, end quote, and other nations. Because it continues and says, or in any state of the lowercase, united lowercase states of uppercase, lowercase America. The United States of America is printed and expressed in their writing, in Montana's writing, as a lowercase u on the united, a lowercase s on the word states, United States, and then the uppercase a for America. It's when it says the United States of America here, the United States is an adjective. It's telling you what it is about America that is unique. It's these several states united. Or as the Congress said when Alaska came in, the freely associated compact states. Same thing. And then it continues, or any foreign country, Canada, Mexico, England, Scotland, Irish, Ireland, and it just, you know, Russia, whatever, any foreign country is on the same level as any one of these freely associated compact states as a country. Now, why did I go to all this trouble to tell you about this? Because it is the fulcrum that PJ leverages and his associates leverage when they deal with your matters. Because every time the blue light goes on your rearview mirror, every time you receive a subpoena or you have an arrest, it is always underscore, bold, italicized, always the Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 government that is dealing with you. And what PJ does is he separates. He forces, not by his assertion or his students' assertions, but by the very assertion of the government in their intercourse with you, their assertion that you are a federal citizen. Okay, evidence it. The rule of law, a maxim in law, is that the one who asserts a thing upon challenge must evidence the thing asserted. Failing to do so, that assertion is a nullity. I'm paraphrasing. Forgive me. So let me at this time turn the call over to PJ. I'm excited to hear his response on this. And take it away, son. PJ, unmute your phone. PJ, I know you're there. PJ, I can't hear you. I see your light coming on, so you're trying to talk. I know that, but I don't hear you. Ah, come on, lad. What's wrong with your phone? Unmute your phone, PJ, please. This is embarrassing, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? This is not the Michael Edwards show. This is the PJ show. I just like to give a good, stunning foundation so that PJ can take that meat and do something with it. PJ, I don't hear you. All right, PJ, I'm going to call you on my I'm going to bring you in on a conference call, see if that works. Give me 1 second. So you might see me call in. I see him there on the board. I know he's here. DJ, I went to your voicemail.
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, there you are. What happened?
I've been here this whole time. But anyway, I've been logged on at least about 7 minutes, I think.
24 minutes.
I was listening to your...
You were saying?
Mute right at the end. But I've been listening to your story about the states and the United States distinctions. So, anyway,
yeah,
go ahead.
That's in writing. That was on their document, a copy of the document I got this morning from Montana. I about dropped my jaw. I couldn't believe it. I sent you a copy of it about an hour ago, 45 minutes ago, an hour ago, I guess.
Yeah, it might be of value to us. But the IRS, they come after us regardless, even if they don't have evidence of the nexus. And it's getting harder and harder to deal with them, but we've got some good people helping us now to force their hand on that. It's been very valuable to us.
Right.
It's not something you want to, I don't think a person has a chance these days to win against the IRS without some really, really good things up your sleeve to counter it. They just do not pay attention to their requirement to produce the elements of, to produce subject matter jurisdiction against, with your activity. Being involved to be taxable. They don't care about location for a nexus, and it's just crazy.
Well, they're called an Internal Revenue Service on purpose. They, if they did apply to all the states and everyone, then they would just simply be called the Revenue Service of the United States, or something like that. But they're uniquely called the Internal Revenue Service. Internal to what? Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17.
Well, or business of the United States. So your right to life, liberty, and property and happiness and so forth, they do not have a general nexus with that. You have to build a relationship with them under benefits and privileges and services and so forth before you become associated with them. And at that moment, either by location or under a license that operates. In their locations, land jurisdiction, do they have a relationship for you to be subject to filing IRS forms, government forms, and paying a tax to the United States off those forms? It's organized crime. No question about it. And the longer they've been doing it, most Americans that I talk to let's just say, you know, I've worked with people that make close to $1 million a year. They are scared to death not to file. They're just scared to death because they've got a good living, and they bring in $1 million a year, and they're so scared that they'll give half their money to the government, to the United States, before they even consider challenging it. And it's I think it's horrendous myself, because they have an opportunity to make the United States produce evidence of taxability without any risk if they do it properly with us, and they're too scared to do it. I think it's cowardice myself. But anyway, that's the way it is. Usually the people that don't pay taxes, quite often anyway, are the people that are not making that much money. And they don't have the, a lot of revenue to fight the IRS if the IRS ever comes after them. Whereas a wealthy person has a great deal more. Actually pretty easy. And that's one reason the government doesn't go after. Quite often, the government only goes after, in my experience, the government only goes after wealthy people after they actually find out that the people have no expertise at all in understanding the distinctions of law into taxability and requirement to file and pay. They usually go after a movie star that doesn't know anything about law, and he's going to completely turn it over to an attorney, which will sell you out. So, does that make sense, Michael?
Yeah, I was just thinking of the fellow I worked for. I was his office manager for almost a year. Eddie Kane, out of Florida. He was in Plymouth, Florida. One of his clients was a actor that played in the samurai movies, the vampire, samurai, killer, whatever his name. I can't remember. American of African descent. Anyways, he was helping him and just was never pulling the right information. Anyways, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I think I know the movie star you're talking about. I actually tried to contact that movie star and help him in his IRS case and just couldn't get through his lawyers.
Well,
I can't
what
remember
do you expect?
His name either. No. Yeah. And they, the lawyers, they're trained, they're professional liars. I've talked to lawyers that give you a big old spiel about how they're going to help you in your case and how many years of experience they have and all this. And they're really smooth and they're intelligent. You ask them, have you ever won an IRS case? No. Not even one. and yet they want $50,000 to $150,000 from you to represent you in an IRS case, and they've never won a case. It's so frustrating. And the lawyers that do win cases, it appears to me like the IRS and the government, they come after them later on and they threaten them. And they chase them away. I don't know what they threaten them with. We've never found out. But it certainly gets their attention, and they start acting fearful, and they quit helping their clients the way they could in a way to prevail, keeping the burden
Snipes.
Of proof on the IRS.
Wesley
Go ahead.
Snipes. Wesley Snipes.
Yeah, Snipes. That's the one.
Yep.
That's fun. Yep. I actually wrote letters to him, and he never, I think the government took him for like $16 or $34 million or something like that, and they just completely ripped him off.
Yeah. And now the reality is he could have rearranged his business affairs in such a way where he was paid, say, $25,000 a year to work for the company that would make millions and millions and millions off of his production of acting. His tax base would be based off of $25,000 income a year, and the millions and millions of dollars that his LLC made, that all of the money would have gone to for paying for that service, would have been mitigated through proper rearranging, using foreign grantor trusts, using a corporation sole, using private interest foundations, in such a sequence that, and you're reporting to the IRS everything that you're doing, everything that you do, you report to the IRS what you have to. And they see exactly what you're doing, and you know what? It's all good. They don't come after you. They would not have come after Snipes had he done it this way, rearranged his business affairs. Back to you, PJ.
Yeah, real sad. It was an opportunity. He wouldn't even respond. I don't know if we could go in and go back and prove that they never had subject matter jurisdiction to tax him now. I just don't know. Some of the things that we've encountered recently is that we've got several IRS cases going, and we're noticing that the federal judges are flat out denying the individuals, they deny them the ability to defend themselves in an IRS case. They strip them of the ability to bring people into the courtroom that could help them. They strip them of their ability to call people as witnesses. And if they do get somebody that's going to help them, they attack that person so greatly that it scares them away, so he ends up not showing up to help. And it's horrendous. And as far as filing criminal charges against the federal judges and the county and the court clerks and so forth that are basically blocking our clients' defenses, we're getting very creative and establishing a record for appeal so that we can stop these people from continuing doing that. Generally, in a case, you've got a tremendous latitude to do as you wish to build your case. And except when it comes to an IRS case, all of a sudden you can't get your documents filed. And in my situation, when I went against the government, I had documents that I filed in open court, and they denied them, and they disappeared from the record, and the oral record disappeared. It's horrendous, just crazy. If it was if the thing was open to the public, where just one person could bring in a recorder and record the case, they could prove that they tried to stack the record of the case against me to where I would lose, but I ended up prevailing anyway, fortunately. But I did realize that I had a personal jurisdiction challenge in the record, a subject matter jurisdiction challenge, a territorial jurisdiction challenge, and it all just... The time before the court, it wasn't before the jury, but before the court, a discussion, that also disappeared from the record. And that is supposed to be impossible to happen. But what they do is they block the people. They were even blocking people from coming into the courtroom to observe the proceedings from carrying a notebook and an ink pen.
That's incredible.
That is crazy.
All right, let's open this up for questions, okay?
Yeah.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, press star 2 on your keypad. Press star 2 to raise your hand, and I'll unmute your phone. PJ will be glad to comment or question or answer your question. Those of you on Freedoms Radio, and we have a strong number there as well, you'll notice the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side in the center of your monitor. Left-click inside of it and type away your comment or question. On the outside of that rectangle, you'll see a place to submit your contact information. Fill that out and then just hit the submit button, and I'll see it on my end. And, Alan, I want to remind you that your microphone isn't open, so anytime you feel like chiming in and making a comment, when anybody takes a deep breath, go ahead and jump in. It's just like you're here on the board, okay? So let's let me refresh, see if anybody's raised their hand. Nobody has. While I'm doing this, Alan, do you have any comments to make?
Well, I'm not too up on the tax laws. I don't believe any lawyers are, to be honest with you. As you say, they'll sell out their clients in a heartbeat. But there's a few ways to, when you approach the court, you can issue a co or rental against the judge. And because a co rental is no authority to invoke the authority of the court. Court does not have the authority to invoke or enforce a sentence if no law exists. And if the judge does not have a co or rental, which is a process of four documents for a federal judge, and three documents have got to be filed with the clerk of courts. And if they're not on file, the judge has no authority to issue any type of verdict. And here's the kicker. 94% of the federal judges do not have the correct paperwork on file.
Yep.
And over 98% of the state judges do not have the correct paperwork on file in order to sit on the bench. And here's the real eye-opener. Three of the nine Supreme Court judges do not have any paperwork filed.
What?
Yep.
Which three?
I don't want to go into that.
Okay.
But it's two of the newest ones have it, and one of the older ones have it, if that'll clarify the situation.
Sure.
But they got to have these credentials, an affidavit, an oath of office, an appointment letter has got to be on file for any judge to sit on the bench. Now, I don't know if this applies to tax law, because the IRS is not part of the federal government. So I could only assume that when the IRS comes after you, it's like on a one-on-one basis. And actually, the judge is going to be on the side of the IRS, because the Federal Reserve is not part of the United States. Its main office is in Paris, France. And
well, my understanding of the IRS is it's a contractual relationship. That when they have evidence that you've gone to the United States and you've done business in the United States to where you've created income domestically in the United States, which upon which the tax is due, but it's a contractual relationship, so it's not a law issue. The law issue comes in if the contract is established, but it starts out with a contractual relationship. So they have to prove that contractual nexus in the beginning, actually, because the courts can only enforce two things. They can enforce law or contract. Now, in some cases, they can enforce law and contract both, but the U.S. courts can only enforce two things, United States written law or contract. Now, contract is on it's very similar to a common law side. and it operates under the principles of, you know, common law understandings of contract, you know, full disclosure, consent, agreement, and then, which the United States actually does that with a United States citizen. When you, if you're from Mexico and you come in as a United States citizen, they give you full disclosure of your contract. They go into great lengths of having you sign all the documents of the benefits and services and your obligations for performance and the ramifications if you fail to do that. That's all explained to you before you take the oath of citizenship. And you do it on a camera where it's filmed, and you have the document signed, and they have evidence of contract there. Now, when you breach that contract, then it's a operation of law for enforcement of the breach. It's very much contract. So that's what we do, is we go in and we force them to produce evidence of what did I say, do, or sign for the court to have personal jurisdiction over you. So they have to produce the evidence of the contract in order for the United States courts to be able to administrate against you. Now, if they do have evidence that you had income domestically in the United States, then you're stuck. But that's what they have to prove. Most Americans do not have any evidence that their income is derived from any domestic business in the United States. Most business, for example, we have an individual right now. He's a dentist, and yeah, he's got a state license for dentistry. So maybe he's got a federal license too. I just never looked at it really close, but they have to produce evidence that the use of that license was actually within the specific income that they're trying to get for taxes is land associated, which means domestically in the United States. You can have a you can sell lemonade all over the country, and some of it might be sold in the United States, and some of it, a great deal of it, might be sold without the United States, as far as land jurisdiction goes. They have right to tax in the United States, but they don't have any right to tax without the United States. And they don't want nobody to know that, because as soon as you find out they can only tax within the United States, you can ask them for documentations of all the land areas of within the United States so that you can avoid those locations.
Yeah, let me jump in here. Yeah, let me recap on what PJ just said that's important, but I'm going to say it a little differently. You have land within the United States that PJ acknowledges you can be taxed. No problem. But you also have land within the freely associated compact states that you can't be taxed. PJ's phrase was without the United States. I used to write on the bottom of my return post location when I would send post through the postal service. I would write write my name, care of, and then the street location, the city, state, and then the zip code I'd put in brackets. And then underneath that, I'd write without the United States. And I would get sometimes negative questions. What do you mean you're without the United States? And they'd have a frown on their face, and their brow would be furrowed. And obviously, they didn't like what they were reading. So I changed it. Once Jennifer showed me this court case when Alaska came into, translated from being a territory into one of the freely associated compact states, that was the actual phrase the Congress used, within the freely associated compact states. So that's what I began using. Instead of without, I began within. And there you go. So PJ's saying clearly, if you're on federal land, you're going to be taxed. If you're on land within the freely associated compact states, you're not going to be taxed. Now it's their assertion. They have to be challenged. Go ahead, PJ. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I don't associate. I'm a little different than Michael. I do not associate with any association with a state citizen or a federal citizen. I keep the burden of proof on them completely. But I believe it could lead into a trap because they, when you go into the state statutes, it says the definition of state is a possession or territory of the United States. So when they say that you're in the state of Texas, state of Nebraska, state of Florida, state of Wyoming, whatever, state of, it is defined, that term, series of words, is defined as a possession or territory of the United States. So I stay completely away from trying to establish any of my land jurisdiction distinctions, and I let them do it completely. Otherwise, it can get messy. It may be very true that the freely associated
compact states
may be completely independent of the United States in every way, but I don't know that for sure, and I keep the burden of proof on the United States to produce the evidence that they rely upon for the income that they claim was derived domestically in the United States. When you're dealing with a United States citizen, they are perpetually, their status of domicile is perpetually District of Columbia. That's clear in their documents. It used to be when you got a Social Security number on the back, it had your address on the back of your Social Security card. As I think it said, 1100 Pennsylvania Avenue, District of Columbia. So they were connecting you to the land of the United States so that if they ever had trouble with your participation, they could use that as one of the prima facie evidences during a court proceeding. I've been in cases where the judge actually used the zip code to get on the record that his income, the defendant's income, was derived domestically in the United States, and which is probably fraudulent because the individual in that particular case, he wasn't working with me, as I never even met the guy. But he, on all his documents, he would use the same address and the zip code. And they asked him during court, is this your address? Is this your zip code? And he said, yes. And the judge used that for evidence of land jurisdiction for taxability. Whereas if the guy would have said, now I've been in court before. I was the only person to win a case in Florida in 8 or 9 years. Not a single person ever won a case down there, Northern District of Florida. And they asked me about my address. And I clearly say that that is a series of numbers that the post office asked me to use. And I put it on the envelope to receive mail. I don't tell the court that it's a address in the United States. I don't tell the court that it's a zip code. I don't do any of that. I just say it's a series of numbers and letters that the mail post office has told me to use to receive mail. And I've always used the without the United States on it. Now maybe I might switch over to the other one that Michael's talking about. I like to use them without the United States because it's so short and sweet. So, but anyway, and then I think it's wise to put these zip code in brackets and just write the word near before that. Let's say my zip code was 68047. That's the zip code out of Midwest that I used to have when I was a little kid. I would just put a square bracket, write the word near, and then a space, and then write what they call the zip code, and then put a square bracket behind it, and that's it. Because you are my business in Nebraska, where I was, it was not evidence as in the United States. But the post office wanted to use their zip code for efficiency of mail. So you certainly are allowed to put the word near there, because that's true. Their federal zone, zip codes are supposed to be only associated with a federal zone. And I did research, and I found some areas that the only federal zone in the area within miles was just the post office. Just the post office was owned by the federal government. No, none of the land around it was owned by the federal government. They have to own land in an area in order to have a zip code associated with it.
PJ, you told a story maybe a year ago where this professor purposely set up an altercation to occur at a post office which was across the street from the sheriff's office or the courthouse or something?
Yes, I could read. Yeah, it was across the federal. It was very close to the federal courthouse. This federal courthouse in Omaha, Nebraska, I was amazed at how expensive it was. And you'd sit there and almost nobody would go in and out of that building. Like, the federal government is just so... they're just like royalty. They build this massive court for their federal courtrooms. And I found out later that they only have one trial a month in that courtroom. One trial a month. And they had this multi-million-dollar building that looked like a Grand Central Station. And it's just for show. It's for intimidation. You go to the courtrooms, the doors are three inches thick. It just show, and the marble and spaciousness and intimidation stacked on top of intimidation. But anyway, okay, so this professor of law, he was telling his law class, he says, I'm going to show you territorial jurisdiction. I'm going to go to this location right across, real close to the federal courthouse. I don't know if it was right across the street or one block over. But anyway, it's close to it. So, and he says that he knows that that post office location has an agreement with the U.S. Marshals that if they have any trouble, they'll run over immediately and help. So he goes in there with a friend. He started a little fight in the lobby of that little post office. And the U.S. Marshal showed up, and immediately he said, well, it's all my fault. That guy didn't have nothing to do with it. I'm just having a bad hair day. And they arrested him, and he ended up in front of the federal judge the next morning. And I guarantee the federal judge knew exactly who he was. That's what they do. So he realized that he's a law professor for the last 15 or 20 years at the area school. I think it was Creighton Law University there. And he got in front of the judge, and the judge started to arraign him, and he says, Your Honor, you lack jurisdiction. And the judge respectfully says, what do you mean, sir? Because the judge knows he's got more knowledge of law than the federal judge does. And he says, I got a document here that says that location of that post office where these events occurred is leased. It's not owned by the United States. So the judge says, bailiff, get that document from the defendant and bring it up here. I'd like to look at it. So he went and grabbed it and carried it up to the judge. The judge spent about, it sounded like 5 minutes looking at it. I don't know exactly how much time, but he looked at it. And then he said, he turned to the U.S. Marshals and he says, release this man and do not bring anybody in here under these pretenses again. So he basically told the U.S. Marshals they didn't have jurisdiction to arrest him. They didn't have any land jurisdiction to arrest him. It lied in jurisdiction elsewhere than the federal government. So he was able to show his class that the United States federal government jurisdiction is limited exactly as the Constitution says, Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 17 of the Constitution for the United States of America. It tells you clearly the land jurisdiction that their legislative written laws have force and effect of law. Basically, possessions and territories of the United States, which is only 20, just a hair under 25% of the American land. And
we have a hand raised here. Do you want to take a question?
That'd be great.
Brian has a question. Go ahead, Brian.
Hey, Michael, and thank you, PJ, Michael, Alan. The question had more pertaining to do with the original statement you made on Montana and the wording there that included other countries. Does that mean, you know, interaction with those countries from the Corp Soul standpoint is?
Yes.
More available, and does that have any implications on setting up different structures from the horseshoe versus which we'll have today?
Yeah, we don't use the word structure in any capacity in our vocabulary because the word structure is a criminal act according to the federal government. So we just don't want to even use the word. And we have to use a longer expression of arranging our affairs, which is a quote from Judge Warner's hand of the 1930s, and he was quoted from, he's a Superior Court judge that has been quoted three times by the United States Supreme Court in that phrase, in his phrasings that he's used, one of them being arranging your affairs. So, but yes, the corporation soul is recognized internationally.
Versus Wyoming?
Montana. From Montana, you can get what's called an apostille. And the apostille is basically a notary that is recognized internationally from the Secretary of State. The apostille comes from the Secretary of State. And they're recognizing those jurisdictions. Just about took my breath away.
Okay. And my question was versus Wyoming. So you're saying yes, right?
Well, it's just that it was on the Montana corporation sole paperwork, and I never saw it on the Wyoming paperwork.
Right. Okay. No, thank you. That clarifies a lot. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, if nobody else is going to ask a question or make any comments, we're going to close it up. We have a great crowd. Go ahead, Alan.
My question is, does the federal government own any land within the territorial United States besides the District of Columbia?
Yes. Everywhere there's a zip code, they're going to own some land. It might be, hypothetically, it could be one square inch of land. And they could put a zip code identifier on that square inch of land, and they would own land in that area. Their written law is. What did you say?
Is that based on? Because I've got documented information here saying that the United States owns only land or has jurisdiction over land of the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and other territories that it claims, but they have absolutely no jurisdiction within the United States, land jurisdiction.
Yeah, they have jurisdiction. Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 17 talked about land that is a possession or territory of the United States. That's how you became statehood. You had to give them some land, you know, in for them to operate in a military fashion for forts, arsenals, and docks and other needful buildings. Forts, arsenals, and docks and other needful buildings have to be...
Right. That land is land. It's not owned. It's only rented. And the federal government pays rent on that land.
Well, if you go to Omaha, Nebraska, I had a case there. If you go to their record, you will see that the IRS building is owned by the United States of America. The titled owner is the land. Is the United
the
States of America.
What
no,
does it give
no,
to the land. Direction of the land?
Anyway, this is what I found. The land is owned by the United States of America. You go to the federal courthouse, it's relatively close to that area. It's owned by the United States of America. You go to SAC Air Force Base, which is one of the biggest bases, at least monetarily, in America, and that is leased land. So you're correct that it's very often leased land. Now, leased land does not have the same jurisdiction as owned land.
Correct.
But anyway, they still have a level of jurisdiction there. But it's a lot more connected to the general jurisdiction of the people under common law. They're not going to let you know that.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
What'd you say, Michael?
No, I interrupted you. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I thought you took a breath.
Oh. But anyway, if you go to the Articles of Confederation, it says that the style of this union shall be the United States of America, upper lower case. I was amazed that when I went into the records in Nebraska that it was written exactly upper lower case, exactly as Article of Confederation requires. Nobody else had their records. Not my land. I didn't see anybody else's land ever written in upper lower case as the owner. Only the United States land. So some lawyer that helped
in upper lower case, you'd be defining the citizen or the actual person or the straw man in place of the citizen. All capital letters on your name make you a straw man or citizen of the United States. If your name is in upper and lower case letters, you become a person or a people.
Yeah, I disagree with that. But
as we people, you are a people.
Yeah,
and you have all capital letters, you become a possession of the United States, the federal government, on this whole deal. And
I agree. All corporations in the United States system are supposed to be capitalized. I agree with that.
They don't follow
it at all times. But because they put all their corporations in capital letters, and then when you purchase land, no matter how you put the records into them in a common law purchase, they're still going to put it on their records in capital letters, which is, they shouldn't do that. But anyway,
and your title or your warranty deed, it will not say owner. It will say tenant. And for all you listening out there, look up the meaning of the tenant, and it's an eye-opener.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't. The warranty deed or the quitclaim deed is only prima facie evidence. The United States still has to prove their ownership evidence of their ownership. And they
remember, you're going to their courts.
They cannot prove it. Yeah, they cannot prove it factually. They cannot prove it factually unless they truly own it. I work with an individual that has taken $30 billion of land off the tax rolls. Every case has been sealed. Huge settlements, all been sealed. And the deeds and so forth, it has no bearing on it. The government has to prove up their taxing authority, and you got to keep the burden of proof on them. If you don't, you won't prevail. It's very, very difficult. As it's even some areas much easier than other areas, but
you got to remember, you're walking into their court.
Well, they'll kill you. You'll end up dead if you do property tax cases very much. They'll just kill you.
Well, I know all well about that.
Yeah.
Yes. $1 million industry.
4 months.
Yeah. I hope to work with you on Title 18 and get some exposure.
Well, Title
18.
Justice Department on Title 18 on February 3rd of 2021 declared that no one should be prosecuted under Title 18. They should refer all prosecution to Title 20 and 21. Because I went to Washington and I testified in front of 37 senators, and many were on Skype, whatever Skype is, and none of them believed it until I furnished the documentation to them. And 2 weeks after that, a memo came out from the Department of Justice that no one is to be prosecuted under Title 18.
What's the date of that document?
It was just a minute here. February 13th, 2021.
Wow, recently.
Yep.
Now, can that operate prior to that? I mean, if it's not law on that particular day, it can't be. It's probably not law.
They're not saying it's not law. They sidestepped it, as the Supreme Court has in three separate cases that I have testified in. They've issued this document saying that no one should be prosecuted under Title 18 anymore. They did not say it's not illegal, but they sidestepped it by saying no one should be prosecuted under Title 18,
right.
Only Title 20 and Title 21. That's how these son of a bitches sidestepped them.
Because I have a Title 19, Title 18, I think it's Title 18 case hanging over me where they claim that I interfered with collection of taxes for the United States, and I used the mail and so forth, and they just like hammering me with contempt of court.
When was that issued? If it was issued before or after?
2016.
Oh, that's before. Okay, that's why.
Yeah.
You'll probably press it. But
yeah.
after the memo was issued, no cases have ever been prosecuted under Title 18. And before that, over 10,732 cases were prosecuted before that date.
I'd like to go in and challenge that if the law was in operation in 2016, they probably don't have enough evidence to produce that it was.
Well, it was in operation by then, but after this date, no one has ever been prosecuted, because I've been watching the federal trials very, very closely. And none of them have been prosecuted under Title 18 at all.
It's I believe
they're not prosecuting
anybody under Title 18 because because it wasn't promulgated properly.
That is correct. Well, when I went to Washington and I testified in front of these clowns, senators, representatives, whatever you want to call them, they were all astonished. And when I started furnishing the paperwork to it, they had big conferences going on. And after I left Washington and I come home, one of our senators, Senator Baldwin, called up and said she had followed my presentation on Skype, whatever Skype is, and she wanted further information. So I sent her 800 pages of information. I have never heard a word from her since. And then all of a sudden, I got the document from Washington, D.C., from Senator Nadler, saying that he went to the State Department and they worked out a situation that no one will be prosecuted under Title 18. But they did not abolish it. But it, in yeah. reality, it never was a statute. But that's how they're sidestepping this whole deal.
Can we get a certified copy of that February ruling, 2021?
I got it right in front of me here.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I'd like to get a copy of that and then get a certified copy of it right out of the government archives. It'd be quite interesting to have that.
Yeah, you'll have to go to it will not be in the Library of Congress. It'll be in the archives, and I doubt if you will be able to get anything out of the archives because everything in there, you can't go in and look at it and see it in volumes, but they will not issue anything outside that. They will not give you a copy or a certified copy out of the National Archives. The Library of Congress, they will. But the National Archives, you cannot get any type of certified copies.
Well, they might if it's part of public record, they might have to.
You're dealing with Washington, D.C. here. I've tried, well, when I was working with another person, I went to Washington several times, and I got documents out of the National Archives. And all of a sudden, the documents that I took out or had copies of, they were not certified. They will not certify them. All of a sudden, the volumes disappeared. And in this meeting, they questioned what volumes there were. I told them exactly what volumes I got them out of. And they sent federal marshals there. And it's turned out that Homeland Security had them. So,
right.
Like I said,
there's ways but if you have a right, if you have a right to them, they we can push it across the bench to meet your right. So maybe we can do that.
Well, okay, I'm going to set up a conference call. Try to, anyways, with Alan and you. And other people in the group that we don't talk about, Friday right. afternoon. Is that
okay? That'd be good. Yeah.
The other people okay. will be returning to home base Friday, Thursday actually. So give them a night's sleep. All right, really good. I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. I told you, I promised you it was going to be a good call, and here it is. So. Until next week, if you want to learn about the trusts and the corporation souls, same phone number, same PIN, same time, but Saturday with a different speaker. It would be Bernie. And until then, next week, tell your friends about us. Good night and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you.